Hi, and welcome to the Big Web Show, Everything Web That Matters. I'm your host, Jeffrey Zeldman, and my guest today is author, designer, developer, writer, entrepreneur, Jason Fried of 37 Signals. Hello, Jason.
Hey, Jeffrey, how are you?
I'm good. I'm very good. How are you?
I'm doing really well today, actually.
I hear you got married in August.
We're getting right into it, aren't we?
Yeah, why not?
I did, yeah. I got married. Something I never thought would happen.
So, because you're,
you know, I'm difficult to deal with. I'm kind of set in my ways, and I'm tricky that way. And you know, I just didn't think it would happen. And I'm also not a very social guy. I don't go out. I don't meet a lot of people. And so I'm introverted and difficult sometimes. So that's kind of a bad combination.
Well, let's get married. Let's focus on that for a minute. You
on the couch? Is there a couch nearby? I should be laying.
No. We're just friends having a conversation. It's not therapy, but because I'm not qualified. I'm kind of introverted. You're introverted. Yeah. You've built this empire, though. How does an introvert manage to lead a company, energize a customer base, and all that stuff? Is it all writing that you or I mean, I know you do a lot of things with remote workers. You've just written a book about that, but
I think it is part of the advantage we have as a web based company, as an internet based company, as a remote company, that I don't have to be very public in person. I used to do a lot more speaking than I do these days. I've kind of pulled way back. And we do a lot of writing, and we get the word out about the writing, and we can focus on making good product and treating our customers well. And those are the things that really made 37 Signals what it is, not me.
But you don't interface with customers that much. You have people who are more extroverted who work for you, right? People who love people.
There's a lot of people here. Everybody here, though, at the company – works customer service. So we all rotate through customer service, every single last one of us. So I love
you. Do customer service?
Yes. Yeah, so, not every day. What we do is we have a customer service team, and then everyone else in the company rotates through on a daily basis. So one day it'll be my turn, the next day it'll be someone else's turn, and we'll go through the whole cycle, and then it'll be my turn again. And so I love talking with customers. It's a thrill, actually, but I couldn't do it in person every day, you know, but the fact that I can do it via email makes it a lot more comfortable for me to interact with people that way.
Yeah, I love email too. I hate the phone.
I'm not good at the phone really, and I would just get tired out. So, you know, when I do public speaking, I love being on stage speaking, and then afterwards when I get a line of questions, people come up to me, I enjoy it for about 15 minutes, and then I actually start to panic a little bit. I have a hard time with that, but I love interacting with people, but not when there's a long line wanting to talk to me. That's one of the areas where the introvert stuff kicks in. There's a great book about this called Quiet.
Who wrote that?
Susan, I'm so embarrassed. I forgot her last name right now. Hang on one second. I want to say Kane, but I might be wrong. Just a second.
Yeah, Susan Kane.
Yeah, Susan Cain.
C-A-I-N, like okay. the boy who killed his brother.
Susan's awesome. Her book is fantastic, and she wrote a book about how introverts are very well suited to run companies, are very well suited to be leaders. It's a great book for introverts and also for people who don't understand what introversion is really all about. There's a lot of great examples in there of people who you would never think would be introverts who actually are.
There's a certain profile of someone who's very public in a certain area that they control and enjoys being in front of people talking, like I do this, and then really need – but like I hate parties. I'll keep on saying I'm going, and then I just don't show up, and it's –
Exactly. I hate that about myself. I hate that I can't just say I'm not going to show up. I'll be like, yeah, maybe I'll go, and I never go.
Because part of it is you don't want to just work. The fruits of your labor are supposed to be that you're surrounded by friends and family, and if you're an introvert, that's kind of hard. But again, you seem to have found with your marriage, you seem to have found a way to have a family, even if you are very set in your ways, have very strong opinions.
Yeah, I found a woman who's awesome, and so, she's similar to me in that way too. So we know each other really well. We understand each other.
How did you meet? If you didn't ever go out, how did you meet?
Well, it's funny. We actually met, I think it was like 7 or 8 years ago. Once we met at a party, and I thought like I should get her number, but I didn't because I don't do that. I'm embarrassed to do things like that. So I just didn't. And then nothing happened for a long, long, long time. And then a couple years ago, I was actually on OkCupid, and I saw her on there. Although, to be honest, I didn't even know it was her. I didn't recognize her.
Wow.
Which is weird. But I sent her a note, and she responded, and she goes, "Do you know we met like 8 years ago or something?" And I go, "Oh my God, yeah, of course I do." And then we went out, and it all worked out.
So where did you go? Kind of,
well, you know, she let's see, where did we go the first time? I'm trying to remember what we did the first time we hung out. Oh, actually, one of the first times we hung out, we went to a boxing match, which I thought was really cool. She suggested this, and I'm like, this is on. This is good. This is good. Like, I've never met someone who wants to go to a boxing match. So we went to this boxing match at this high school here in Chicago. It was kind of sort of a gritty night, and it was kind of cool just to be in that environment. I've never seen something like that before. It was amateur boxing.
Amateur boxing at a high school? Not by high school students, though.
No, it was like just amateur, you know, amateurs. But
it was just a venue. The high school was a venue.
At the gym or however they do that. I think they might do it, you know, every month or something. I don't know the details. But I think we didn't do that the first time, but we did that early, and that was really kind of a cool moment. That's like, wow, she's really cool. I like that. And, you know, just obviously – you know, we broke up once, you know, from after we met again, and then like got back together. Like, you know, it's kind of a difficult thing for a while, but then it got really, really good. And it got really, really good when I got really, really honest about the things that I need and the way that I am. And she was totally welcoming of that. And that was the moment when it all changed. I'd always sort of...
Are you like a never nude? Is there some like weird secret?
No. It's just like I was just honest about the things that are important to me about, you know, I need my own space. I need my own time. Like there's things I just know I need. And I've always tried to kind of hide those because I thought that those things would be unappealing.
But she's the same way?
She's the same way. And like it's, you know, it was just a moment where when you get super honest and you lay it all out there, it goes in one of two directions, and it went in the right direction here. And then that changed everything for us. And we got married at our house, very small event, 12 people, just my parents, her parents, and then her sister's family. And that was it in the backyard.
That's lovely.
Yeah, it was great. Really simple. Then we had lunch, and that was that.
Given your profile in the business community, you could have easily been like a playboy type. I mean, because you're young, very successful.
Yeah, well, I don't know. That's not my thing.
Yeah.
That's not my thing. And I don't talk about, you know, this is actually the first time I've talked about this in some sort of a public recorded venue thing. I didn't tweet this. I just don't really share my private life publicly. So anyway,
no, but,
I love you. So, you know, it's kind of cool to do that with you.
Thank you. I'm really honored that you would do that. And that, you know, we won't pry any further. I seem to share a lot, but there's a lot, obviously like tons I don't. It's weird though, because if you have a public profile like me, people think they know everything just because they know some things.
Yeah. Yeah. That's an interesting thought. I mean, you know, you're a deep, very deep person, and there's only so much you can share, anyway. And if people think that's all they know about you, then, you know, they don't know enough because you're a really interesting guy. I mean, everyone knows you're interesting, but there's so much more to you than what you would tweet out, things like that.
Well, there's more to everybody.
Yeah, there's way more to everyone, and I've just always chosen just like, you know, my public profile is you know, I run this business and I care about the products and I care about our customers and I care about design, I care about these things, and that's what I'm going to talk about, and I like to leave my private stuff out of it, and that's how I've always been. I'm that way even with friends sometimes. I just don't talk about things. I'm just, that's how I am.
How much of the voice of 37 Signals is you?
I mean, I'd say a fair amount is me and David, my business partner. You know, we have a similar voice. I mean, we have different ways of expressing ourselves, but we have very similar points of views when it comes to business. And I think the voice is sort of a hybrid of both of our points of views. And then also, you know, I'd love for the company's voice to be more about everybody who's here. Some people just don't, you know, aren't comfortable sharing, and people want to share more. And, you know, we're trying to figure out a way to make that happen. You know, we've always asked people, like, you know, you can post on the blog whenever you want. You can do
sure. Whatever.
And, you know, not everybody does, and that's totally fine. Part of the reason why is some people are a little bit intimidated by it sometimes. Other people aren't sure what they're allowed to share. And the answer is you can share anything and everything, whatever you want. So I think just over time, more and more people will get comfortable with that and do it. But
do you have an onboarding process for that kind of stuff at Happy Cog, we've had discussions like that, obviously, and encouraging everyone to write, and then recognizing some people aren't comfortable, and, you know, and that's okay, no pressure. But finding other ways for people to just sort of, I've always thought it's really important, and Greg Hoy and Greg Story the same. You're part of a company or anything, but you shouldn't be hiding in it. You should always be part of this community. That's the most important thing that you're doing. Whatever you're doing at the company is great, but find a way to contribute, find a way to let people know who you are. I think as a designer, you really can't have a career if you, I think you might have a really unhappy career if you just sort of find a niche and go, okay, here's this place, this company's great, they treat me really well, I'm just going to shut up and do my work, and I'll do 20 years of brilliant work, and then I'll be fine. You sort of have to let people know who you are. I mean, I think
it depends on what you want. You know, some people are just happy in the shadows doing excellent work because that's what completely satisfies them, and that's fine. Some people like to be more vocal and more public. That's fine. We don't have, and maybe we should. I don't know. We haven't thought about it, but I haven't thought about. You know, it's funny. Sometimes you're so used to something, you just forget what it's like to be new at it. And, you know, our blog's very popular. A lot of people read it. I think we get something like 100,000 visits a day. And so it's intimidating for someone to write something on that because the audience
sure.
is so huge. And I've kind of, in some ways, forgotten that. I'm so used to doing it now. But if you're new with the company and you want to share, like, the first place to share is usually not in front of 100,000 people. And so maybe we need to figure out ways to encourage people to share things internally first, although there's a lot of internal sharing going on in our campfire rooms. There's tons of stuff going on, and it'd be fun to bring some of that stuff out. I don't know. We'll see. I don't like to force it, though. I think
right.
it'll be, if it happens, it happens. It should happen naturally, and I should just, you know, continue to remind people that they're invited to share any way they'd like.
You do have a huge, huge platform, and that would be like, it'd be like going off the high dive for your first public swim. Just like, yeah, that would be very intimidating. But you've always had, I mean, I've known you since you were like, I don't know, 22. I met you when you were like a 22-year-old copywriter or something.
Probably.
When you started the company, I don't know what you had done before, and that would be interesting to find out, but you had started the company with four partners, one of whom was a legendary graphic designer.
Yeah.
And you'd written, you called it 37 Signals, and you'd written 37 pieces of copy that absolutely staked out a position in the market. Like, you didn't. So let me paint the picture. It was the 90s for people who weren't around then.
99.
Everyone else who was doing client services was basically doing a flash site with a flash portfolio site showing like all kinds of crazy, like really out there, graphically intense, bandwidth heavy motion work, right? Sort of like,
yeah,
people inspired by Hillman Curtis, but maybe Hillman was always very tasteful, maybe pushing it even further than that, or else people were very sort of corporate, right? Razorfish, yep. Companies like that. And you guys were like, there was no company like you. You sort of came out and you took a very strong position about user experience and relating to customers and how to engage with the market and how to be honest and transparent about it. And you started, you were using words like transparency and stuff really early. In a weird way, reading your website in 1999 was kind of like reading the Clue Train Manifesto in 1999.
Remember that, yeah.
And when I met you, I should have been meeting like a team of 40-year-olds. But it was like basically like a lot of that copy was coming from you, and you were like very – how did you develop such a strong voice? What had you done before? And
Well, by the way, if anyone wants to read that site, it's still online. If you go to 37signals.com/manifesto, you can see that original site, which was 37 ideas, and that was it. We didn't have any portfolio work up there, didn't show any client work. It was purely about ideas and points of view, and that was it. And it lasted – like we did that for I think maybe 3 years we had that site up or something like that. And it established us as different, as opinionated, as you know, I've always just felt like –
Right, like not full service.
Yeah, that was the other big thing. Everybody at the time, as you alluded to, was like full service, you know, database stuff, business consulting, you know, marketing, all this stuff. And we just said we didn't know how to do any of that stuff. All we knew how to do was design websites and mostly redesign websites. You know, we didn't really bring people online. We would redesign what they had. That was our focus. And it was always focused on simplifying things and bringing more clarity to the messaging and cutting pages out of sites and making things smaller. That was just what we'd always done, and that's what I've always believed in and still do today. And so, I don't know, what I did before was I was just a freelance website designer. I worked on my own from 96 to 99, basically. I'd taken a few contract jobs at a few places, but mostly it was just me on my own. And then my first big break was I got the job to redesign Getty Images' site called Getty One. Actually, not redesign, to design. They were launching this thing called Getty One, which was an umbrella site which allowed you to search all the different Getty libraries of images. And this woman named Krista Mascarella, she'd somehow seen my work, and she took a huge gamble on me. And she said, I want you to redesign this site. I gave her a proposal. I think it was something like 90 grand or something, you know, big number.
You said that as a freelancer?
Yeah.
In 1999?
Yeah.
And where did you get that number?
I'll tell you where I got it. I got out of my ass is where I got it. But what I wanted to do was I wanted to hire somebody. And so I thought to myself, because I was working on my own, I thought, like, if I get this job, I can hire somebody. So what do I need to hire someone to pay their salary for a year and to pay myself? So I'm like, I need about 90 grand, I think. If I get 90 grand, I could pay myself fine. I was just living, you know, in a one-bedroom place, working out of my place, and I can pay someone's salary, let's say, I don't know what it was at the time, 40 grand or 50. I don't even remember what it was. But with that money, I could have this thing, and that's where I came up with a number. It had nothing to do with anything else about how long it would take, or it was just, what did I need? And that's how I've always priced things. I've always thought about it that way. What do I need to do what I want to do? And anyway, wow. So she took a gamble on me. I mean, I owe her so much. And it was no joke. It wasn't like I was hiding that I was one person. You know, it wasn't like I was playing this we card where you use the word we a lot and we a lot and we a lot as if there's a huge army behind you. It was just me, and she knew it. And I was bidding up against big firms, and she went for it. And that was my big break. Allowed me to hire my first employee, who stayed with me for 11 years.
So and you were you already 37 Signals at that point?
Oh, I was a company called SpinFree. That was my own like little consulting name, SpinFree. And before that, I'd been doing some FileMaker Pro software projects and some stuff like that way back when. And,
did you ever have a job working for other people?
Oh, yeah. I mean, in high school and junior high, I've worked since I've been 13. I've done a ton of jobs. And this is actually what's really shaped the way I run my business, because I've worked in a lot of different places, pumped gas and detailed cars and sold shoes and worked in grocery stores and all this stuff. And I saw some good things in each company and some bad things in each company. And I sort of built this hybrid model of what kind of company I'd want to run. And I wouldn't want to be like this owner, but I would want to be like this person. I wouldn't want to be like this manager, but I would want to be like this one.
How did you know? So when I was 16 working, I just wanted to get high. I didn't go, wow, this is a lesson that I'm going to use when I construct my own business someday. Occur to me.
Yeah. I mean, I wanted to get high too, and I did. But I didn't think about building a hybrid at the moment. I just put the stuff in my scrapbook mind kind of. And then eventually I think that those things – like it wasn't a deliberate situation. But
okay.
I eventually realized that like I don't want to treat people like this guy treated me at this job.
Right,
like,
right, right.
For example, I worked at this place called Sport Mart, which is like a sports authority kind of place, if you guys know what that is. I don't know if that's all around the country or not. But anyway, I think it probably is. Anyway, big, huge sporting goods store. And the manager was this woman who was just didn't trust anybody. And she would look over our shoulders constantly while we were trying to sell shoes to customers. And I just felt so uncomfortable. I'm like, why? You know, you obviously don't trust me. Why would you hire me if you don't trust me? It doesn't even make sense. And so like today, it's the same thing. I don't like to look over people's shoulders. I want to trust people to do the right thing. I don't want to assume they're going to do the wrong thing. And those are these small lessons that looking back, you can connect these dots. But I didn't really know it at the time. But I did have I had a ton of work experience. My dad and my grandfather were entrepreneurs, so I think I got some of it from them in some ways.
What did they do?
My grandfather started a grocery store chain called Eagle Foods, which was a Midwestern grocery store. I think they started out in Rock Island, Illinois, or Moline, Illinois, or Bentendorf, Iowa, some like the Quad Cities for anyone who knows where that is. It's on the border of Illinois and Iowa, basically. And they started there, and it grew to a certain size, and they sold it to someone. And but he was into the grocery store business, and I've always loved grocery stores. I love walking through grocery stores. I think walking through grocery stores is the best lesson in marketing you could ever get. There's everything is there for a reason in every position. Every label is trying to catch your attention. All the words, everything, like the colors, the shapes, everything. To me, it's so invigorating to walk through grocery stores and think about. Nothing is happening by accident here, and I love that. So he had a grocery store. My dad worked for someone for a while and just didn't like it at all and went off and just became an investor, just stock trader for a long time and still does that on the side. And I think I learned from him that if you can work on your own, it's the right model if you can make it work. For me, that is. Not everyone's that like that, but I could tell that I was that way. And so he always encouraged me to figure out how to do it on my own if I could. My parents are wickedly supportive of me and always have been. And I have a lot. I owe them everything for that reason. I mean, I remember when I was running track in high school, track I was good, but I played on the basketball team in high school freshman year. And I'm a short guy, like you, or short Jewish dudes, right? And, you don't really, I made the freshman team, but I played like 3 minutes the whole year. I was on the bench every game, right? Never played. But my parents still came to every game, and that's the sort of stuff that really made a huge impact on me and still does to this day.
So when they sent you to work at age 13, that was also supportive.
That was all about, you got to learn what it's like to earn a dollar. You've got to, we were a upper middle class family. Probably a little bit more upper than middle, I think. Although my parents never really let me know, and I still don't really know.
My parents, yeah.
I don't know. Like maybe my parents have tons of money saved. I don't really know. And we lived comfortably, normal house sort of thing. But
my daughter's always asking me how much money I make, and I just tell her I don't know.
Yeah, which is the truth.
That's actually true, right? That's actually true. That was bad during my divorce because my ex-wife wanted to know, and I was like, I don't know. And of course, her lawyer thought I was being coy, but I don't know, really. Wait, ask me at the end of the year is basically –
Funny, I'm the same way. I don't really keep track of that stuff. I just never really have.
Well, I used to, and I was poor. I was poor for a long time, and I was really, really kept track of a dollar, like how much can I afford and can I get this and that. And it's weird how – And I don't know, what the causality is, but it seems like you begin to get a little successful. You just let go of that, and then you get more successful. It seems like, at least, that's my experience. I don't know.
When I was in college, I had no money. I had nothing, and I remember that too. But I always remember just feeling like I'll figure it out. I have nothing right now. Like it's funny. I don't spend money in crazy ways. But I remember in college, I always wanted this guitar, this electric guitar, this G&L electric guitar, and it was like $1,000, and $1,000 was the world to me. I didn't get it, and I saved up. I was doing some freelance web design, early web design stuff. I was selling some software, this FileMaker Pro stuff that I made, and I saved it up, and the stupidest thing in the world to me would be to go spend $1,000 on that guitar, but I did it because I knew that I'd be okay. I'd figure it out, and it was nice to feel like to have that confidence, but also to feel that that scarcity, like, wow, I really don't have anything now. I got to figure it out. And and that lesson to me is important. It's something I always talk to entrepreneurs about. This is why I'm so opposed to people taking money early on, raising money from investors, right? Because what happens is when you have money in the bank and you have a lot of cushion, what you get really good at is spending money. You don't really get good at making money because you don't have to. And I think right. You need that struggle, and you need to know what it's like to have to really make that sale. It's the best education you'll ever get. And if you postpone that education for too long, you're just going to not know how to do it when you absolutely need to do it. So anyway, long rant on that, but I've done all sorts of jobs and all sorts of things, and I think pulled a little bit of experience from each one together into how I want to run my own business.
Yeah, I did a lot of jobs too, but I always felt helpless and like I was never going to get another job. I really didn't come into my own until I started working for myself. And that's, again, just me. Other people don't have that problem. But
and look how well you've done. I mean, you've built – talk about an empire. You're a publishing mogul now, conferences –
I have partners with all these things. I don't do it all myself. But
they wouldn't have come together without you. So take credit for that.
But that has evolved. Once I did the same thing that you're talking about, once I was older, I couldn't do it when I was younger. Once I had the confidence to just walk away, I left a job where I was getting paid and I said, no, I'm not happy. And I got a couple of freelance things lined up, not a $90,000 job. I think it was a $6,000 job, right? I got a $6,000 web design job for a radio station who should have been paying a lot more, but I didn't know how to price anything and all that. But I just left. And I remember I got a consulting gig for $1,000 a day, which was amazing. So much money, more money than I'd ever made. And I walked out on it after four days because the client didn't respect me and I didn't respect the client, and it wasn't a good situation. I made it my fault and I walked away. And as I walked away, I was like, I didn't know how I was going to pay the rent, but it was snowing. It was cold and my girlfriend couldn't work and wasn't working. And it was like a terrible situation. And I just thought, I had the comment. I just thought, I'll be fine. I also thought, cause I'd figured something else out, that I'm never going to take a job I don't believe in.
So you just built on that confidence.
That's like, and Happy Cog, that's totally been the foundation of it, right? And the couple times when I've strayed from that and taken on a client that I didn't believe in or that I was uncomfortable with, it's been a disaster. So, but
I've learned that lesson so many times too. I mean, it's never, I just find it's almost never worth, if you don't feel it in your gut, if you feel like it's the wrong call, like you just got to not make that call. You got to do something else. And you have to have the faith in yourself that like things will work out and you'll figure it out.
Well, you trust yourself as a designer or as a writer or as an experience creator, whatever it is, you have to. Otherwise you shouldn't be in the business. I've always had, I love usability. I want everything to work. I believe in testing and research and all that stuff too, but sometimes I worry that can be a crutch. I think you guys are held up consistently with 37 signals. You guys are held up by UX people like Jared Spool with respect. He'll say, like, when they say something like self-design, scratching your own itch, you're the canonical example, 37 signals. They didn't like the project management tools that were out there, so they built their own, and they didn't do tests. You know, this is not to say that you never listen to customers, and for all I know, you do run tests, but I think basically you guys are known for having a vision of something you want to make, making it, improving it over time, and the usability comes from people using it over time.
Yeah, that's it. And I think it comes back to, again, knowing it's going to work out. So, or having faith that it's going to work out. The best testing I've ever seen is shipping something to real people who use it in their real daily, you know, every single day and depend on it. And they're the ones, and charging people for it. And they're the ones who are going to give you feedback. I hear this all the time from people. They're like, how do you get customers to tell you what they think? I say, you charge them for your product. Because when people pay for something, they tell you what they think.
They're entitled to.
Yeah, they're totally entitled to, but also like they're now invested in this thing. Right. And like they're going to be honest with you. When you give stuff away for free, people are like, yeah, it's cool. It's awesome. You know, they don't care as much. And so you don't get good feedback. So I think the best way to get feedback is to ship something, charge for it, and then iterate in the wild. you know, and make it better over time. I mean, that's how everything gets great, becomes great. Things don't get great in the lab. I just don't think things become great in the lab.
It is possible to become passionate about something that you get for free. Like I love Foursquare as an example. Mm-hmm. And I would definitely pay for it.
Yeah.
My fear is that they'll go out of business. I have terror that companies that raise too much money at a certain point, their investors say, you know what, we're going to pull the plug, even though you're successful. You have customers, they like you, but you're not, we're never going to make the kind of profits we want. Go ahead.
Yeah. What makes me sad about that whole thing is that what ends up happening is a lot of great ideas end up going away because they either have to be big hits or they go away. And that's such a bummer because, and I don't know Foursquare's financials and stuff, but let's say Foursquare could be a $15 million a year business. I'm sure, whatever. Let's just say it could only make 15 million bucks a year and they had a staff of 30 people. That's an awesome business.
I know. I agree. That's
an awesome business. Right. And like, when did that become a small amount of money? When did that become, you know, it's such a great business. But
do you know my friend, Brian Alvey?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. He's the weblogs guy, right?
Right. He sold Weblogs Inc. with a partner to AOL, and he's made all kinds of things. And he was told by an investor in a company he did recently. I think he said this, told me the story on the show, but it was like the investor said, you know, most of my, what do you call someone you've invested in?
I don't need portfolio companies.
Right. Most of the companies I've invested in have the decency to fail.
What?
Because he was, like you're saying, he was like making $8 million a year with 15 employees or something. And by any normal human standards, that's success. You created something that didn't exist before. You have customers who love it. You're feeding families. You're creating work. You're, you know, all the things that we think businesses that are cool about business. And, but the investor wasn't getting like a, you know, a 500% return. The investors now in the world that we inhabit, they really want, they would rather lose money on a bunch of stuff and make, well, it's kind of like the music business. They want a huge star. They don't want to find a band that has a loyal following and you know, whose records are mildly profitable. They don't want that. That's not interesting to them. They want like some crap that's going to be supremely popular.
Yeah. And the thing that sucks the most about it is that what ends up happening is customers get screwed. I mean, for example, if Foursquare went away, if they had bought by someone else and someone shelved the product or whatever, like you'd be pissed. Like you would lose.
There goes all those, like I made all these lists of restaurants in all these cities that I like or museums that I like or something in different places that I want to share with friends. There they go. They're gone.
And this happens all the time. I mean, if you pay attention to this stuff, like you have a great little company who's like, let's say it's an invoicing company and they've got a nice little customer base and they're doing okay and they get bought out and the product dies and a couple founders make some money and then all these customers are shit out of luck. And it's like, man, what a terrible thing for the industry to be proud of.
Well, that's the other thing. Yeah. A lot of times people think failure is okay. Erica Hall talks about this all the time because the people at the top don't really fail. It's someone else's money. And even if the company gets sold and they make a profit and everyone who worked for them loses their job and gets nothing, they consider it good. And that's crazy to me.
I agree. I think you and I are on the same page there. And what the long-term implications of this is that people are going to trust web-based software companies or app developers or whatever less and less and less and less and less because as more great ideas go away because the companies don't become huge hits, people are going to be like, why would I invest in this new idea because it's going to be gone in 2 years? Or why would I put my data in this company because they're going to be gone in 8 months? And it's going to hurt everybody. Everyone's going to get hurt this way except for just the top, 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 top. And it's unfortunate. I don't know. I could rant on this forever. But
see, when I believe in something, I buy – I mean even just out of fear of the company going away, I'll buy a pro account, right? And yeah. I mean – you could say, well, you're lucky enough to be in a position to do that. But in most cases, we're talking about something like $30 a year. It's not a huge investment. Most people could afford it. It's like, you know, if you skipped one cup of coffee a month, you could pretty much be doing this. So
like Pandora is a great example of that. Pandora's, I think, way too cheap. It's like $36 a year. It's also free with ads. And, you know, I listened to the free version for a while and I barely heard the ads. They didn't bug me. But I'm like, I want to support these guys. This is a great service. I love the service. So I'm in for $36. I'd be in for $50 or maybe even $99 a year, whatever. Like, I want to support those things. Someone told me something once, which just really changed my whole perspective on how to spend money, which is that every dollar is a vote, basically. And when you spend your dollars, you're voting for the things that you want to see more of. And, you know, it's like when I buy a car or something, I'm not just going to give my money to the people who give me the lowest price. I want to give my money to the people who treat me the best and who are good people that I want to support, because I want to see more of those people. I want to see them stay in business. And so I've been thinking about dollars as votes more so than dollars as anything else. And when you start thinking about it that way, you're like, I want to, when I buy something, I'm voting for these guys. I'm voting for these guys. I want to get behind these guys and support these guys so they stay around, so they stick around, and so they can continue to do the things that they do that help me out and help other people. So I've been thinking about it as votes. It's great. It's a great way to think about it.
I love that. Are there any companies or products that you buy where they don't treat you all that well, but you love the idea of them, or you love something about them so well that you keep on supporting them?
I haven't really run into that. I mean, there's a couple. Okay, well, I can say, like, I'm not thrilled with my bank. I'm not going to say who it is, but, like, it's a big bank. Everyone knows these big banks. And I'm like, they haven't done anything to me personally, but I don't really like their values. I don't like what they stand for. I don't like some of the things that are going on. And I haven't moved my money. You know, I haven't moved it somewhere else. And so that's, you know, indirectly, I'm voting for them, even though I really shouldn't be.
Banks are tough, though, because that's not a
– yeah.
That's not – I mean, there's nobody pure of heart. I don't know of – well, except for, like, one religious bank. There's a Muslim banking system there where they, you know, they deliberately don't make a profit off the money they loan and however. But
I mean, I've heard about that.
But other than that, right?
Well, what's cool is so my wife, her father was in the Navy. So she banks with USAA. Do you know USAA?
United States.
I'm not sure what it stands for, but USAA is basically, I think it's actually a credit union. I might be getting this totally wrong, but they offer bank accounts, insurance, you know, loans, every financial service you can imagine. And they are exceptionally well liked by their customers, or their owners, I guess you would call it, because if it's a credit union, everyone's an owner. Customer service is off the charts awesome. Everybody loves them. No one has a bad thing to say about them. People, if you take out a USAA credit card, I've seen people be like, oh my God, you have USAA? So do I. They're awesome. I mean, who talks like this about a bank? So I've actually moved some of my money over there. And I'm sort of trying to experience what that's like. And they're just awesome. They're really, really good. But they're the only ones I've found. So that's an example of me, you know, this big bank I'm with, I'm supporting them, but I really shouldn't be because I don't like their values. Although the individual people I deal with there are great. I don't have any problem with them. So it's one of these tricky things. It's a constant, you know, struggle.
It's kind of like you may not love your web hosting company, but it's really hard to change web hosts. There's so much involved in that. And like so many things can go wrong. You just have so much anxiety that you can end up staying. It's like staying in a bad marriage. You can end up staying in a broken hosting situation if it's not too terrible. Exactly like a marriage. In fact, well, it's not so bad, right? You know, he drinks, he beats you up. Well, he's not that bad, right? And that's like people stay in a bad marriage and people stay in a bad hosting. Well, you were down. Well, we're mostly up, you know, and like, yeah, they didn't respond to your emails for 2 days. Yeah, well, but it's just such a hassle to move. And I kind of think banking's not as hard as but like refinancing your house, that's a big deal, right?
Oh yeah.
Suppose you said, "Oh, I don't really like this bank. I read this news story. They did this terrible thing." But do you really want to try to refinance? I mean, you could, and that would be a very ethical thing to do, but
well, the problem with that too is that when you take a loan out, it's usually sold to someone else. So, you know, you could spend all this time leaving this one loan or this one bank who has your loan on your house, and then you go sign up somewhere else and they sell it back to that other bank. I mean, there's just, it's very hard to get away from that. You never really know. But I mean, you do what you can. And I think if you just start thinking about money as or dollars as votes, you know, maybe you'll change some of your behavior. You know, no one's going to change everything, but maybe you make a few better decisions. Like, for example, briefly, I just bought a new car recently and there was a dealer local to me who had the car in stock, almost had the car in stock that I wanted. And they were like 30 miles away. I'm like, I can go drive up there and just buy the damn car. But I really just wasn't – I was being rubbed the wrong way by the sales guy. I just didn't like dealing with him. And so I went on cars.com and I found a car in Chattanooga, Tennessee. So I called the dealer over there and I had the best possible experience I've ever had with a car dealer. This guy, I'd never met him before. He's in Chattanooga. He had the car I wanted. He was awesome, very easy to deal with, knew about the car, didn't pressure me. Like, fantastic opportunity, right? And I'm sitting here like –
In Chicago. You're in Chicago.
I'm in Chicago. And I'm sitting here like, man, I could have this other car today if I just went up to the dealer and just like kind of held my nose and just bought the damn thing and it'd be done. Or I have to wait like 2 or 3 weeks to get this car from Chattanooga. And I actually like thought about it overnight a lot. And I asked some friends about it. And my friend's like, who do you want to vote for? And this is where the whole vote thing came from. It's like, who do you want to vote for? Do you want to vote for the guy who's being an asshole to you? Or do you want to vote for the guy who's just working really hard for you and a really generous guy and a nice guy and who's just great? And I'm like, you know what? I'll wait 3 weeks and I'll get the car from the guy in Chattanooga who's been awesome. And I want to vote for him. I want more people like him in the world than people like the other guy.
What was his name?
His name is John Lancaster. And he was awesome. And if anyone's looking for, I think it's like Porsche, Land Rover, Jaguar or something. If anyone's looking for a car, one of those brands, John Lancaster at Chattanooga Porsche, Land Rover, Jaguar is the guy to talk to. He's awesome.
Wow.
He's a car guy too. What's so funny is a lot of these car dealers, they're not car guys or car people. They don't really know about the car. You end up going there and you know more than they do. And this guy knows cars. And like he's just – it was fun to talk to and fun to buy a car from. And he took care of me and he was just great. He's awesome. It's just a great experience. And so it's just one of those things where like I'm so proud of – I'm not proud is the wrong word. I'm so happy that people like that exist, and I'm happy that I was able to vote for him, basically. And I wrote his sales manager an email saying, this guy's fantastic. I mean, this is the best car buying experience I've ever had, and I've never met the guy before. You know, and I trust him. He's going to send me the car that's the one I bought and the whole thing. And that's another way to vote for people. A lot of times we always complain about – like someone will complain about service or say something is bad. But if something's great, I think you got to point that out too, because people need to hear about that stuff as well. So I've really been working hard not to be negative about anything publicly and really just point out the things that I think are great out there.
That is a great way to evangelize and do it.
Yeah. It's hard sometimes. You want to like – you just want to poke something here and there.
Those are always more fun, juicy. Yeah. I mean, like critics love bad movies.
Yeah.
You know, and the late Roger Ebert used to say that. He said, you know, I feel bad, but those are the most fun to write and they're the most fun to read.
Yeah, right? They are. I feel like there's enough critics out there. So if hopefully I can be on the other side, I'm happy to play that role. And it makes me feel better, to be honest, just to point out things that I think are great and things that I admire and whatever.
Now, you're the co-author of, with David, of two New York Times best-selling books. What is it like? I've written a book. I've written a couple of books, and one of them did well in its area. Like a lot, you know, was influential in its area, and I'm very happy with that. But New York Times bestseller. I can't even visualize like how many people are reading it. That's where you actually make money from a book, which most people don't do. Right, most people write a book and like it gets them better speaking gigs, or it helps them get better clients, or they have the satisfaction of having shared their idea, or you know they got 50, you know they know that they have a small community of readers, it makes them happy. But you and I'm not, the money is not the important thing to me. What like the scale of influence is pretty impressive to me. Like you got people who weren't there for the internet, weren't there for the web, don't really care about a lot of the things you and I care about and haven't really come of age with those things, but they're paying attention to you. Like a lot of people are paying attention to you guys' ideas. That's pretty impressive to me. How does that feel and how did it happen?
Well, just to be clear, the latest book, Remote, is not a New York Times bestseller. It didn't make it, but Rework is. I just want to make sure that that's on the record there. But what's interesting, I'll tell you an interesting story, which is something that's kind of interesting. So, Rework, our first book, Rework.
Well, it was your third book.
Technically your third book, yes.
Right.
But our first book on a major publisher, major.
Which
major,
is Harper Crown?
It's Crown, yeah, which is Random House.
Random House.
Yeah. So, that was a big book. I think we've sold close to 300,000 copies of Rework.
Wow.
Big time book. Continues to sell really well today, and it's great. So Remote, in its first, I think, week and a half or something, sold maybe, I think it was close to 10,000 copies, which is a huge number. But this is something I didn't really know about. It didn't make the New York Times bestseller list, even though it outsold many of the books in the category. The reason why it didn't make the list is because the New York Times bestseller list algorithm is a secret algorithm, first of all. No one knows what it is. And it's not just based on sales. It's based on the diversity of sales. So it turned out that about 98 or 99% of our books sold in that first week were sold on Amazon. And I think we only sold maybe 100 copies in physical bookstores. And so our sales are so skewed towards one bookseller that the New York Times basically frowns on that, and they basically dock you points for that.
But that's the world right now.
Now it is, but yeah. I know a couple things. So that's the world. You're right. I think 6,000 of those books were on Kindle as well. So it's like the whole new world now. But
My copy's on Kindle.
Yeah, Kindle. I mean,
I would expect many of the sales to be on Kindle. But again, that's coming from my background, how I know you. I would think all the people that know you the way I know you guys would buy, you know, in iTunes or Kindle. But
yeah. Yeah, so it's, you know, the thing is that I kind of understand New York Times' point of view here, because what if they're only looking at one bookseller? You could potentially – I could just place an order for 50,000 books on Amazon and just have them shipped to our office and then be on the New York Times bestseller list if it was just purely about sales numbers. However, what I learned is that there are – this kind of blew me away, and I kind of think it's disgusting. There are companies out there that you can hire – to buy books for you all around the country from different bookstores to make sure that you make the New York Times bestseller list. So
if it's black hat SEO in the
In the books. So if you want to put $100,000 down, you can be number one on the New York Times bestseller list by hiring one of these companies to go out and strategically buy books in different places from different booksellers at different times of the day, the whole thing for the first week, and you will make the list. And so
But you're out $100,000. Is the idea that you'll make millions somehow?
Yeah, the idea is that once you hit the New York Times bestseller list, things like take off from there. And so you're making a bet. And many, many books that you would see on the Times bestseller list that you've never heard of in a certain category, you might wonder how they get there. And they may have a bigger strategy, which is this one author wants to get a New York Times bestseller so they can put it on their resume. So the next time they go, they get a much bigger advance. And so that $100,000 they outlaid up front, they'll get it back two or three times over in the next advance. I mean, there's all these things. All these games being played, and
of course, well, our political system is that way. So why wouldn't book selling be that way?
Everything's that way.
Everything's that way.
We were, you know, Rework. We didn't play any games. We happily ended up on the New York Times bestseller list. Remote, we didn't. You know, we tried, and it would have been nice to make it, but we didn't. We just were announced to be one of the top books in 2013 on the iTunes or in the iBook store, which is cool. We hit a few number one categories in Amazon, which is great, and people are really liking the book, and that's what really matters. But
have you guys read The Year Without Pants by Scott Berkin?
I didn't read it, which I probably should have, but I didn't want to read it while I was writing our book.
No, but after, just to compare.
Yeah, it's on my Kindle.
They're both red. They both have red on the cover.
I have it on the Kindle. I just haven't dug into it yet.
Yeah, because Scott, he worked at Automatic for a year, and it was new to him, and he did it. You guys are talking about it from the perspective of people who built a company this way, who built, I guess, several companies this way or several products this way. Mm-hmm. And he was talking about the experience of working at a conglomeration of open source projects under this roof started by Matt Mullenweg, right? So he was talking about it from the employee side of it.
Yeah, Remote hits it from both sides. But yeah, his book is about the employee side specifically. And, you know, Automatic's a really interesting company because they have, I think, 200-something employees, and they're 100% remote. We're kind of a hybrid in that we have an office. We have about 14 people who work in Chicago and then, you know, 27 or so other people who work in 25 different places around
you
the
have,
world. So we're kind of a hybrid.
You have the most beautiful office I've been in. And I've been in the offices of some impressive architects and other like impressive folks. It's just it feels so handcrafted and beautiful. It's a huge, to me, huge I'm from New York, so to me, like the extra space that you have in Chicago, you know, like Chicago's not cheap either, but you do get more space. But it's just there's so much wood and there's so many beautiful little objects. It's like a little museum.
Thank you. We, you know, it was a luxury spend for us in that, you know, we for the first 10 years of our existence, we didn't have our own office. We subletted space from other companies, and it took us 10 years to feel comfortable enough that we're going to be here for the next 30 years, hopefully, that we could invest big in this and build a place that we all wanted to work in. And so that's what we did. But I don't ever advise companies to go off and do that unless they've again struggled through not having a space. You don't want to put a bunch of money into real estate, into an office space if you don't know what's going to happen in the next
You had a mild, I wouldn't call it a quarrel, but like a little friction with Mike Davidson when he had been an art director at ESPN.com, a really talented guy, and then he created Newsvine, or he and some, I don't know if he was the sole creator or worked with partners, but you had just, do you know about this?
Maybe no, I don't think unaware. I do. I mean, I know who he is and I know the site. I don't think I remember this,
though. I think he had just, I believe, man, I hope I'm not attributing this to the wrong person, but so they had just gotten this beautiful office in Seattle when they sold Newsvine to MSNBC. And they had like this beautiful Newsvine. I think it was like this neon thing on the outside and beautiful space, and you would just come out and give him this big talk at South by Southwest Interactive where you said the worst thing you could do is like take money from someone else and like spend it on an office and spend it on neon and stuff. And I think he thought you were talking about him personally.
Oh god, no, I had no idea.
And you know what, and we're gonna say maybe it wasn't Mike Davidson, I don't know. I'm getting very old and my memories get very jumbled, so I don't know.
Saying something like that, and I think it's, you know, it's the wrong place to put your money initially. I think again, if you've established your company and you're going to be around and whatever, you know, then it's okay. And leases are long. You know, we have a 10-year lease here, so you know, you got to really be comfortable that you're going to be here for a while. And,
the place I should say to people who haven't been there, it's not stupid or luxurious either. It's not like there's pool tables and all kinds of nonsense. I mean, it's a workplace. It's just that the aesthetics of the workplace are nice. There are desks and chairs and phones and computers, but everything's kind of nice. So you can feel at home. And I always think, you know, feeling comfortable where you work is important because it's really another home.
It is. And we tried to design this place like a library is kind of the way I think about it. And that when you walk into a library, there's certain etiquette. You don't interrupt people. It's quiet. People are focused on learning and working, and that's what we wanted to do here. And so we used a lot of acoustical materials, in fact, to keep sound transmission down, to make sure that if people are talking, it doesn't interrupt a lot of other people. We don't have a lot of sound and echo bouncing around. We have a culture of respect and quiet. And then we built these rooms, these soundproof rooms. In fact, I'm in a soundproof room right now doing this talk with you, so I don't bother anybody else. Where you can talk full volume but not interrupt anybody else. And so it's the architecture and it's also the philosophy of the company and the culture all coming together to form a great space that's appropriate for us. It may not be appropriate for others, but for us it's a great fit.
I'm going to interrupt you right there just for a second. We're running out of time and I realize I've been so fascinated by today's conversation that I neglected to thank our sponsor. So let me take a moment to do that. We got Warby Parker sponsoring today's episode of The Big Web Show, and we're very excited about that. Warby Parker has the coolest selection of vintage-inspired glasses, and they're all super affordable. This is kind of girlish of me, Jason, but let me ask you a question. How many pairs of shoes do you have? More than one, right?
Yeah, I have maybe 7. I don't know.
Okay, there you go. Then, so why do you only have one pair of glasses? People aren't looking at your feet, Jason. Try Warby Parker. If you're not sure what to get, try Warby Parker's home try-on program. Warby Parker is the new way to get boutique-quality, classically crafted eyewear at a revolutionary price point. And listeners, guys, bottom line is you can support this show by ordering your glasses online today at www.warbyparker.com. Use the promo code WEB, that's W-E-B, all caps, during the checkout, and you'll receive free expedited 3-day air shipping. At least go check it out. And don't forget, that's warbyparker.com, promo code WEB. Thank you, my friends. And thank you, Jason. This has been, to me, it's always a pleasure talking to you, I got to say. And
fun.
I feel, this is weird, but like we see each other or talk to each other just every couple of years.
Yeah.
And,
I don't know.
But it always seems like we just reconnect. Like.
Yeah. You're easy to talk to and you ask good questions.
Thank you. But I have my best friend is Fred Gates, and I met him 20 years ago. I met him, hung out with him one day, and I didn't see him for a year. Uh-huh. And a year later, he walked into some place where I was, and I said, "Hey, Fred." And that's like I reconnected with the guy, and that's how I've always felt with you. So,
well, thanks. I feel the same way. And by the way, if I want to actually plug Warby Parker too. How about this?
Oh, yeah? Nice.
As a company, I think what they're doing is fantastic. The eyeglass industry is such a mess. The fact that it costs $500 for some frames, at some places, it's outrageous. I love what they're doing to bring really cool looking glasses and well-built glasses for, I think they're like $100, including lenses, or $150. I don't know. I haven't looked at the prices lately, but they're significantly less. And I just, it's such a great thing to see someone actually changing that business, because for the longest time, I felt like it's such a racket.
You are right. And not only that, but there's still 2 days left to send a gift card for Christmas arrival. So if you celebrate Christmas, as many people do, this is a really nice thing. They hit a milestone of half a billion glasses distributed, I believe. What? Is that even possible? Jesus. What's 500,000? Yeah, that's half a billion.
500,000.
Oh, 500,000. Okay, I'm a very unreliable narrator. Well, the 2 days left to send a gift card for Christmas arrival is still true. So that's Warby Parker. I like their typography too. Nice website.
Great site. Great service. Everything about them is really cool. I like them a lot.
I'll say one more thing, because we really have to go. But one more thing I've noticed you guys doing a lot lately, which I've been doing lately and I really love, is this sort of, although you've kind of all. You know what? If you go back to your original site, where it was just, it was 37 articles, at 37signals.com manifesto.
Let me just double check. It's at manifesto. Hang on.
It is, because I looked at it earlier. Our original site from 1999.
There it is.
There it is. I mean, is it even? It's even liquid.
Yeah.
So you were doing responsive design before there was responsive design, kind of. Well,
you know, what's funny is everything used to really be responsive design. Yeah. When you basically had nothing going on, everything just worked.
Everything was responsive design, but looked like crap. I think responsive design is where, I mean, I think what Ethan Marcotte did with responsive design is say, okay, let's think like designers, but let's know that we don't really know what size device and what kind of device the person is using. Let's make sure that our design works for everybody. I think the problem with liquid design, I started doing that too back in the 90s, and then I hated it so much. I loved the idea of it, but I hated how ugly everything was with the terrible line breaks and everything. Responsive design, because we have tools to do it now, lets you have aesthetics and a good presentation. But what I was going to say about you guys' design is that you've always put the content first, and maybe that's because you grew up in a grocery store, and you worked in a grocery store, seeing how everything's there for a reason. But you have,
it's like, so the economy of letters and words, and you know, it's all about communication. And sometimes the words are just the best way to get the word across. You know, sometimes you don't need incredibly fancy visual displays to say something, and many times, incredibly visual things distract from the actual message. I see there's a trend going on that I know we're going probably over time here, but there's a trend going on right now in modern web design, which kind of bugs me, which is every website's starting to look the same again. It's like huge photos, parallax scrolling. It's this whole thing, this very lifestyles design sites. And it's cool when a couple companies do it, but when everybody does it, everyone's site looks the same again, and then the messaging is lost, and then it's like everyone's talking the same way, and all the language is very, very precious now, and everything's beautiful and handcrafted and artisanal, and You know, I don't know. I think we need to get back to I really admire more like folksy design. These sites where you go like mom and pop shops. You know, you go to their website and you can tell like maybe their cousin or their son like did it in their spare time, and the sites are really communicative. That you can read them and you know where the links are, and they're kind of a mess, but it kind of doesn't matter. And they explain themselves very clearly, and you just pick it up compared to these elaborate presentations, which are all about the presentation and very little about the message. So,
well, there's another trend that's been around for about 5 years, which I think you guys had played a huge part in. I think you've been very influential. I don't think you get enough credit as designers, but this whole, I mean, it's kind of like Ogilvy Reader ads, that mentality. And for people who aren't familiar with that in advertising, Ogilvy would do these ads, and maybe there was one strong visual, but basically there was lots of copy and little illustrations bringing out all the wonderful subtleties about the product and all the reasons you might want to interact with the product. And people would actually read these ads, and nobody reads anything. And people would read these ads. And therefore, you know, people who make like really good camping equipment, or people who make really, you know, really good whiskeys, or whatever Ogilvy's clients are. And you guys have taken that approach in web design, where there's like these big punchy headlines, not trying to be clever, just explaining a benefit very clearly, very well targeted. There's these illustrations, maybe again like little signs in a grocery store, but tasteful, right? Your eyes just led right through the page, and the hierarchy of type and everything is really beautiful and clear. What the site's about and what's most important, what's next most important. I think there are business sites that follow your lead, and I like those sites. I think they look really good. I think this sort of content first, big type, not comically big, but just, you know, making sure that people can read.
Yeah.
I mean, and it, you know, you've always been a writer, so I get that, but.
That guy's a hero. I mean, Ogilvy is like the old VW ads and all that whole generation of ads. It's like, yeah, you'd have the big picture up top, a punchy headline, and then maybe like two or three columns of short text below, and you couldn't help but read it. And every word mattered. And because it was short enough, you knew that you could finish it in 20 seconds and you get something out of it. It wasn't too long, but it wasn't too short that it was like leaving things out. And it was just right. And I've been constantly trying to find that just right point with every website that I do, and you know, sometimes you hit it and sometimes you don't, but it's such a fun challenge, and I enjoy forgetting about all the fancy display options that are available to us today and get back to just what are the words that matter, what do I need to tell someone right now, what's the best way to tell them. And I know it's a fun challenge.
Well, I think you guys were content strategists before anyone used that term, but I think that you've always, you know, in your marketing sites, you know, not in your apps, but in your marketing sites, I think you've always been, and even in your apps, one example that I used to love for years in Basecamp, if you were logged out, it used to say, just sign in and we'll send you right along. Yeah. And I thought that was really a nice, friendly touch on what could have been a, you know, log in here.
Right.
It was an opportunity to be human.
Everything is. This is the last thing I'll say. Yeah. Everything you do in your company is marketing, is advertising, is messaging. So every moment you're speaking to somebody, you need to think about what you're saying to them and how they're going to take it. So every word, you have to expect that every word you're writing is going to be read, and then you got to think about how that's going to be absorbed. So if it was just like, please log in again, period, it's like that's a terse way of saying something. Who wants to be talked to that way? You know, but if you were standing next to the person, you'd be like, hey, just sign in again. We'll get you right back where you were, or something, whatever. Just try and think about writing conversationally, what it's like to actually receive those words and to say those words. That's the way to think it. You have to think about writing from the reader's perspective. I think that's the most important thing. A lot of people write to write instead of write to be read. And I like to write to be read. That's how I kind of think about it. And I mean, not to kiss ass, but you know, you're one of the best writers on the web or period. I forget the web, but I've learned a lot from you over the years. Wow. Too. You're really good at telling stories, and that's something I'm not that good at. So I want to learn more about that from you.
Well, I really want to thank you for all the time you've given us today and for all the products you and your partners and team members create. And this has been another Big Web Show. Thank you very much, Jason Fried.
Thanks, Jeffrey. It's been really fun.
Cool. And bye-bye, everybody.